Okay, we'll begin with the salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo studying the greater discourse at Asatpura. This is sutta number 39 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this sutta the Buddha is explaining the step-by-step graduated training for the monks to explain what are the things that make one a samana, that's an ascetic. What are the things that make one a Brahmin? Here he's using the word Brahmin in the sense of a holy person, a spiritually accomplished person. Please don't forget to give Boyao ink here. Okay. Ichang. Okay, so just to review what we've covered so far, the Buddha explains this, a kind of step-by-step process, beginning with the sense of shame or moral, what I call the inward sense of self-dignity or self-respect and fear of wrongdoing. Then he proceeds on to purified conduct of body, speech, and thought or mind, and then purified livelihood in paragraph 7. So those are the three aspects of, or the four aspects of training in sila, in virtuous conduct. Then, beginning in paragraph 8, the Buddha lays down the training which is intended to internalize the process of self-cultivation, to prepare the mind for the development of samadhi, or deep concentration. And so here we have the training and restraint of the senses in order to prevent the mental hindrances from arising, especially the hindrances of craving and aversion. One exercises, one guards the doors of the sense faculties so that one doesn't mentally grasp upon attractive and repulsive sense objects. Then, having restrained the senses, one practices moderation in eating. That is, eating enough to keep the body in good health, but not overeating and not eating to enjoy the variety of delicious tastes. Okay, then one undertakes the training in meditation by the practice of what is called wakefulness, practicing sitting and walking meditation throughout the day. Then in the first watch of the night, one continues the practice. In the middle watch of the night, the middle part of the night, one sleeps mindfully. One wakes up early and practices walking back and forth and sitting meditation in the last watch of the night, and then one continues through the rest of the day. So this is the practice of wakefulness. And when one is engaged in other activities, then one practices mindfulness and full awareness, for better mindfulness and clear comprehension. That is, being mindful in all the various activities and being fully aware or having a clear understanding of what one is doing when walking, returning, looking up, looking to the side, when bending and stretching the limbs, and so on, and in all the different positions, walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Richard, did you have your hand up?
No, what is sleeping mindfully?
Okay. Well, basically it means that one goes to sleep mindfully, and it's said that if one is very diligent and very accomplished in the practice of mindfulness, then one can even maintain the mindfulness during the sleep.
Doesn't that mean one really isn't asleep?
No, no.
What does it mean?
I think in ordinary terms, let us say that one falls asleep mindfully, so that when one lies down, one is aware of lying down, and as one drifts off to sleep, one is mindful as drifting off to sleep. But in my own experience, if one is going to fall asleep, one has to, in a sense, loosen up the mindfulness, not hold it too tightly. Because if one tries to press the mindfulness as one is sort of drifting off to sleep, it'll keep one from falling asleep. Yeah, so he says, in the middle watch of the night, we will lie down on the right side in the lion's pose, one foot on top of the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in our minds the time for rising. So it's not saying that one actually maintains the mindfulness during sleep, but one goes to sleep, goes to bed, maintaining the mindfulness and clear comprehension. And then one makes the mental note as one lies down that one is going to wake up in such and such a time, when one gets a sufficient amount of rest, so that one doesn't just continue to lie in bed after the time for waking up goes by. Okay, so then we come to the section on abandoning the five hindrances. This I dealt with in detail last week. And so here the Buddha is describing the monk who goes off into a solitary place and then sits down and abandons each of the five hindrances, here called covetousness, elsewhere called sensual desire, and ill will, and sloth and torpor, or dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. Okay, so then the Buddha ends this passage by saying that he has the simile of five types of constrictions or constraints: being in debt, being ill, being in prison, being a slave, and being walking across a desert. Walking across a desert without knowing where one is going. And so when one abandons the five hindrances, then the Buddha says one sees that condition as freedom from debt, as good health, as release from prison, freedom from slavery, and as having reached a place of safety. Okay, so this much is what we dealt with last week. And now we come to a section on the four jhanas. These are meditative states of deep concentration or samadhi, which are reached when the five hindrances are abandoned and the meditator wants to go into deeper samadhi. And so we have two terms here. One term is samadhi and the other term is jhana. And now there are different approaches to the development of meditation. At the point when the five hindrances are abandoned, one approach, which has become very widespread today, in today's world, is the approach of what is called sometimes dry or simple insight meditation. And so when one overcomes the five hindrances, one gains a certain degree of samadhi. The mind, as the five hindrances are abandoned, the mind becomes collected. This is the meaning of samadhi. The mind, which is literally, it means put together. Or we could say even composed or collected. But most translators now use the word concentration. Okay, so when the mind is concentrated in samadhi, sufficient degree of samadhi, one can then turn directly to the practice of insight meditation by observing the arising and passing away of phenomena. It could be the basing oneself on the breathing, one can note the alternation of in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath, or one can note the rising and falling of the abdomen, or one can move into the walking meditation and just note right step, left step, right step, left step. And then one can start to note these processes at subtler and subtler levels, with finer and finer subdivisions. And so in this way, one will be getting keener insight into the impermanence of bodily and mental processes. So that is the approach of what is called simple or dry insight. The other approach is the approach of developing strong samadhi first, and then using that strong samadhi as a basis for insight. And to develop the strong samadhi, the meditator cultivates these four levels of mental concentration, which are called the jhanas. And so what happens as the mind starts to become concentrated is that a certain object appears before the mind. It's usually an object like a point of light or a ball of light, which is experienced in different ways depending on the particular mental formations of the meditator, depending on the meditation subject. But for example, if one is doing mindfulness of breathing, in the area where one experiences the breath, the sensation of the breath, this point of light, or circle, or a sphere of light starts to appear. It might be white, could be pinkish, red, light blue. And then the meditator will focus the mind, to let the mind sink into that light. Technically, the light is called nimitta. Nimitta simply means something like an object, but it's the special object that appears through the development of concentration. Okay, so the meditator focuses on this nimitta, this ball of light, point of light. And as the meditator is focusing on the nimitta, certain mental factors start to become more prominent in the mind. First, there are two factors which work closely together. It's hard to find really satisfactory translations for them in English. In Pali, we call them vitakka and vichara. The word vitakka, in ordinary usage, means thought or thinking. But it also has the sense of the application of the mind to the object. It's sometimes compared to maybe using a hammer to hit a nail through a board, except when it's not using the mind forcefully, but when it's sort of gently and softly applying the mind to the object. So that mental application to the object, or directing the mind to the object, or mounting the mind on the object, that is the work of vitakka, which here we translate applied thought. Along with vitakka, there is another factor involved, which in Pali is called vichara. Here it's translated sustained thought or examination. But again, vichara isn't really thinking discursively the way we ordinarily do. But rather, vichara is the factor which we might even call it observation of the object. Not analyzing, not trying to develop wisdom out of the object, but just observing the object. Examining the object. And it's said that vichara places a continued pressure on the object, or it keeps the mind anchored on the object. Okay, so now as vitakka and vichara are able to remain steadily and sustained on the object, the mind feels as though one's mind has come into a clearing. It's like going through the jungle of forest of wandering thoughts. And now one has come into this clearing where the mind is able to sustain itself consistently on the object. And so this brings a great sense of purity, of inner freedom. And with this, there arises a kind of joy, a joy that becomes more and more intense to the level where it can be translated as rapture. this state of joy or rapture in Pali, it's piti, which originally has the sense of refreshment. It's a kind of refreshing of the mind. As though, you know, in India, the weather is often hot, and so it's like a hot person diving into a cool pool of water in the middle of the day. The body feels so cool, so refreshed, so relieved of all of the heat and weariness and sweat from walking in the hot sun. And this joy, it's not like our ordinary joy if we get the Christmas present we want or a delicious meal on Thanksgiving, but it's more like, even like a physical sensation, a kind of blissful sensation, both mental and physical sensation that runs through the whole mind and body. And then accompanying this joy or rapture is a state of mental pleasure. This is not the coarse pleasure like sensual pleasure, but it's a pleasant, easeful, comfortable feeling. And this is what is called in Pali Sukha. So we have these four factors in this state of the jhana, but these four factors which are building up and leading to the jhana. That is, we have the workers, you could say the two workers are applied thought and sustained thought. They are the ones that have the responsibility of focusing the mind on the object and sustaining the mind on the object. And then the two rewarding factors, the factors that experience the reward, are rapture, piti, and this pleasure or happiness, sukha, blissful happiness. And then going along with them is the fifth factor, which is called one-pointedness of mind. And the Pali word is ekagata. Eka means one, aga means a point. And so ekagata is unification of mind on the object. Like all of the scattered, dispersed streams of thought are now collected and brought to bear on the object. And so the mind remains fixed, unified, one-pointedly on the object. And as these five factors gather strength, a certain point is reached where the mind goes from the level of ordinary mind into the level of the first jhana, a completely different state of mind in which sensory experience falls away and the mind remains steady on the object. Even though first, when one first achieves the jhana, it might just be for a few seconds, but the mind has reached a new level. It's not a level of insight, wisdom, or enlightenment, but it's a level of concentration. And so, according to the way of explaining the first jhana, it has, this is according to the analysis of the Abhidhamma, it has these five jhana factors. Vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, chittase, kagata. That is, applied thought, sustained thought, rapture, pleasure, and one-pointedness of mind. Okay, and we find this described here in the sutta. Here I'm on page 367, paragraph 15. This is the standard text on the four jhanas. Having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections or defilements of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, that is, now the mind has left behind the five hindrances and all other unwholesome mental qualities, he enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Then to describe this state further, the text says, he makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill and pervade this body so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Okay, and then to illustrate this, the text uses a simile. Maybe it's not so familiar to us nowadays because we have these spray cans in which all the work is done for us, spray cans of shaving cream. Just as a skilled bathman or his apprentice heaps bath powder in a metal basin and then sprinkles it gradually with water and kneads it until the moisture wets his bowl of bath powder, soaks it and pervades it inside and out, yet the bowl itself does not ooze. So we could even think of a bowl of the shaving cream, if you squeeze it out from this spray can, you get a bowl of the shaving cream, and it's wet, but you can't separate the water from that soapy substance. But wherever there is the soapy substance, the water pervades it. And wherever there is liquid wetness, it's pervaded by that soapy substance. So the two are just perfectly mingled. And so in the same way, the monk makes that rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, drench and so forth, this body, so that the whole body is pervaded by that rapture and pleasure. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions so far on anything that's been said before we go further. Should we move on then? Okay, so now this first jhana is a very, you can see it's a very blissful, very uplifting state, but the Buddha doesn't stop here. In this sutta, he wants to show the whole sequence of the states of samadhi. And so he's going to move now through the three higher jhanas. Okay, so now to move on, before moving on to the second jhana, what the meditator has to do is first to master the first jhana. One doesn't just gain the first jhana temporarily and then think, now I can move on to the second jhana. But rather what one has to do is to master it. To master it means that one has to be able to enter it again and again until one gets familiar with it. Maybe it's a little bit like a child or a student who learns who's learning arithmetic, and once he learns to multiply, he learns the multiplication tables, 9 by 6 equals 54, 9 by 7 equals 64, 63. I was just testing to see if anybody was listening. I was doing right. No, he's still he's sleeping. He's sleeping this morning. He had a busy time this past week. Okay, so just like when the student learns the multiplication tables, 9 by 8 is 72, 9 by 9 is 82, 9 by 9 is 81. Okay, then you don't stop teaching him algebra, but he has to learn different, how to do multiplication in different ways and how to do division in different ways. And only when he really knows his multiplication, division, adding, subtracting, then one could teach algebra. And so one has to become very familiar with the first jhana, entering it again and again, so that one can enter whenever one wants, and one can stay in it for long periods of time, an hour, 2 hours. One can come out of it whenever one wants. If one makes a determination, I'll stay in it for 1 hour, then as soon as the hour comes to an end, he'll automatically come out from the jhana.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
This first jhana, when you say you have to master it, is that conjuring up the light and just staring at it?
Bringing up the light and it's not so much staring at it, but focusing on it. That's preliminary to the jhana. But when one is able to enter the jhana at will, of course one will have the nimitta as the object, but it means just that as soon as one makes the determination, I'm going to enter the jhana, then one just focuses the mind on the object, and then one can go in very easily. One doesn't have to struggle with the five hindrances. Okay, so now to go further, what one does, one knows, from having been acquainted with the suttas or the discourses, that the first jhana is not the end of the road of samadhi. And so one knows that there is a further state beyond the first jhana called the second jhana. And then what one does is to reflect on the first jhana, and one sees that these two mental factors, vitakka and vichara, apply thought and sustain thought, are disturbances. Even though the first jhana, compared to our ordinary state of mind, is very peaceful, very blissful, but still there is this mental activity going on of the mind applied to the object and sustained on the object or anchored on the object. And so one sees or reflects that this applied thought and sustained thought have a disturbing quality. And because of that, the mind can't become extremely peaceful. And then one considers that the state of mind in which applied thought and sustained thought are gone will be more peaceful and more excellent than the state of samadhi in which applied thought and sustained thought are present. And so this reflection arouses a strong determination to reach the second jhana. So having made that determination, One then again practices concentration, and then one goes through the first jhana, but doesn't stop there, but goes on to the second jhana. Apply thought and sustained thought fall away, and one enters the second jhana, in which there's still rapture, there's still happiness, and there's necessarily this mental unification or one-pointedness of mind, but there's no more disturbance by thought and examination. So the text says here on paragraph 16, again, with the stilling or quieting down of applied thought and sustained thought, the bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence. I think that's not such a good rendering here. Because self-confidence usually means, you know, like when I get up on before an audience, I don't feel nervous or anxious about speaking. Or when I come to a business meeting, I can put my ideas on the table without feeling intimidated. That's not what is meant here, but it's rather sampasadana, atano sampasadana. It's, maybe we could call it pacification of mind or clarification of mind. So it has this inner clarification, inner clarity, and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought. And it has rapture and pleasure. It's piti and sukha, born of concentration. And so now the concentration has gotten stronger. So applied thought and sustained thought vanish, and there remains present this rapture and pleasure, stronger than the rapture and pleasure of the first jhana. Okay, again, he makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body not pervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Then we have the simile. Just as though there were a lake whose waters welled up from below, and it had no inflow from east, west, north, or south, and it would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain. Okay, there would be a cool font of water at the bottom of the lake, and that water would well up from the font into the lake, and it would make, and the cool water would drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake, so that there would be no part of the whole lake not pervaded by cool water. And so too the bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body not pervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. It's interesting that we have here another simile which emphasizes coolness. Maybe this is typical of the Indian environment where oppressive heat is the problem, but perhaps in North America during the winter time, we would use, if the Buddha were living here, he would use similes of a kind of delicate warmth pervading the body rather than coolness. Okay, so this is the second jhana. Okay, now, before moving on to the third jhana, again, the meditator has to master the second jhana. It's not enough just to be able to enter it almost by chance, through intense effort, to enter it just for a few minutes. But he has to be able to enter it, to get, to acquire the skill of entering it at will, to remain in it as long as he wants, and to emerge, to come out precisely at the time determined. Okay, once he acquires this mastery over the second jhana, he doesn't come to a stop, but he now recognizes that there are these two factors, rapture and pleasure, which are closely associated in the second jhana. But the quality called rapture, in Pali, piti, when one looks at it closely, one sees that it has a certain disturbing quality to it. You know, like when you feel joyful, even if it's a really wholesome kind of joy, but still the mind, it's not really calm and peaceful. Not perfectly peaceful, but there's a kind of exhilaration in the mind, a kind of excitement, some degree of excitement. And so after one gets well acquainted with the second jhana, one starts to see that this rapture or exhilaration causes like little ripples on the mind. So that the mind is not really perfectly settled. And one knows that there is a state of samadhi in which rapture is absent, but there is still this pleasure or happiness or bliss, and that is the third jhana. And so one reflects on the defect or shortcoming in the second jhana, the presence of rapture, and one reflects on the benefit of the third jhana, the bliss without rapture. And then one makes the determination to experience that bliss without any rapture. And so when one's faculties get strong enough, then one goes into the second jhana and past the second jhana. As rapture falls away, one then enters into the third jhana. And so the text says, again, I'm in paragraph 17, again, with the fading away as well of rapture, the bhikkhu abides in equanimity. Now equanimity, or balance of mind, is becoming more prominent. And mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, he enters and dwells in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding, who has equanimity and is mindful. Okay, so the way we find this third jhana described in the suttas, if you look at the table, in the right-hand column, what is absent, what has fallen away, is rapture. And applied thought and sustained thought are also absent. And what is present is equanimity or mental balance, mindfulness, clear comprehension, and then this pleasure, which is said to be experienced by the body. Okay, then elaborating, the text says, he makes this pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body not pervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. Then we have the simile. It's just like there might be a pond with blue, red, or white lotuses. Then there are some lotuses that are born and grow in the water. They thrive immersed in the water and don't rise out of it. And so that cool water drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades these lotus flowers to their tips and their roots, so there is no part of the lotuses not pervaded by cool water. In the same way, the monk pervades, makes this pleasure divested of rapture, drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body. Okay, so this is the third jhana. Again, this isn't yet the end of the road of samadhi, but there is a state beyond the third jhana, which is called the fourth jhana. And what is distinguished by the fourth jhana is that even this pleasant feeling or blissful feeling falls away and is replaced by a feeling which is called neither pleasure nor pain. That is, it's a completely tranquil feeling. It's considered the most sublime kind of feeling. And so the meditator first masters the third jhana, then after becoming thoroughly acquainted with the third jhana, he reflects that this pleasant feeling, this blissful feeling, is a little bit dangerous because it's a potential object of attachment. Because the mind sort of becomes attached to bliss. And if one becomes attached to it, then one could fall down into lower states. And one reflects that the state of feeling, which is called neither pleasure nor pain, is more peaceful and more excellent even than this pleasant, blissful feeling. Then one knows that there is a fourth jhana in which pleasure falls away, replaced by neither pleasant nor painful feeling. And so then one makes the determination to reach the fourth jhana, and then at a certain point, now I'm reading from the text, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and has purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. He sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Then the simile, just as though a man were sitting covered from the head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his whole body not pervaded by the white cloth, so too the monk sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body not pervaded by the pure, bright mind. Okay, so here we have the fourth jhana, in which the feeling is neither pleasant nor painful feeling, and there is now what is called purity of mindfulness. That is, now the mindfulness has become thoroughly purified, very bright and pure, and there is a perfection of equanimity, perfect mental balance. Okay, so this now completes the description of the four jhanas. And at this point, I'll ask whether there's any questions on the four jhanas. Okay, first Tracy.
I'm interested in the rapture follows. This is purely speculative.
You're interested in
how rapture falls away and mindfulness appears.
Yeah.
I would assume my understanding of mindfulness is that reflective quality. One is able to reflect on the deficiencies of the first jhana, the second jhana.
Yeah.
That reflection.
Yeah.
Partakes in mindfulness.
Yeah.
Isn't that mindfulness?
Okay, this is a very good point. And actually, for this meditator, mindfulness will be present throughout the whole process, even bringing the stage of abandoning the five hindrances. Mindfulness has to be present. In attaining the first jhana, mindfulness is present. The second jhana, too, mindfulness is present. In examining the faults of the lower jhanas, the benefits in the higher jhanas, mindfulness is present. Okay, so mindfulness is present throughout the whole process, but it's mentioned only in connection with the third and fourth jhana, because there, it seems, the function of mindfulness becomes more conspicuous or more prominent. So it's not a question of absent before the third jhana, present only with the third jhana, but it's a question of prominence. So its function becomes more prominent in the third jhana.
This might be too simple to ask you, but
too simple.
It might be too simple of a question to ask you, But the fourth would be nirvana.
No, the fourth is not yet nirvana. Yeah, these are just states of mental concentration. They don't even imply the achievement of the higher wisdom or liberation or nirvana.
Now, can anybody that's a layman or even someone like myself who's a beginner, could one even hope to experience something like this, or is this just something that we would know that someone at your level?
We could certainly have the hope and aspiration to achieve them, and if one makes the effort and one's faculties are strong enough, one could achieve them.
Even the first would be very difficult.
Excuse me?
Even the first level would be very difficult.
It's difficult, I mean, even for us, but one can achieve them. And I know of lay people who do achieve them. And what I found, you know, by questioning and the talk that comes around, this is interesting, you know, it's a little bit, in a way, contradictory to what the texts say, but it seems that the ability to achieve the jhanas depends to a great extent on a person's aptitude, mental disposition, rather than their way of life. So, many, many monastics who lead very diligent lives of meditation don't achieve the jhanas. Whereas sometimes I hear of lay people who just meditate for a short time and they're said to achieve them.
And that's been in some of the Buddhist stories, I believe.
One sees them in some of the stories. Usually what they get like that is stages of awakening. The jhanas usually take some persistent effort. It's not just like instantaneous. It takes some effort, but I hear like lay people who go to meditation center and stay for some time, and it might be their first time at a meditation center, and they achieve the jhanas. Whereas, you know, monks who are practicing diligently, maybe for years, don't achieve them. So it depends, I would say, to... It doesn't mean that I should disrobe and become a lay person, get a 9 to 5 or a 9 to or an 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. job and hope to achieve the jhanas that way. But It seems that a lot that goes into this is what we would consider a person's paramis, that is, the qualities that they've developed in earlier lives, as well as just certain faculties that certain people might have. But what I would say is that the way of life that conduces better to the achievement of the jhana, or that conduces more effectively to the achievement of jhana, is a monastic way of life. So even the lay people who, I hear, achieve the jhanas do so by going to a meditation center or a monastery to do a long period of meditation. Not that they sit, with Wall Street or office, thinking, let me take, or the Googleplex in California, and then think, let me just take 15-minute break for meditation, and then they enter the jhana. Maybe some do, but.
Could you please define a certain degree of some concentration for insight meditation?
Okay, the question is, can I please describe or define what is meant by a certain degree of samadhi or concentration for practicing insight meditation? Actually, there isn't really a fixed degree of samadhi, because some teachers use, in the approach of dry insight, start the meditator off using the approach of dry insight, even from the start. And so what they do is to start with an object that's always changing, and just note mindfully whatever object arises to the mind. So, for example, in the Burmese system of Mahasi Soyodaw, one begins usually with observing the rising and falling of the abdomen. Then if one experiences a wandering thought, one just makes the mental note, wandering mind. If one is remembering something, one notes remembering. If one is planning, one notes planning. If one feels pain in the body, one notes pain. If one feels pressure, one notes pressure. If one feels hotness or coolness, one notes hotness, coolness. So one keeps on noting. But then what happens through the continued process of noting, then the mindfulness becomes stabilized, so that one is mindful of every experience that's occurring. And then the mind can remain on its object consistently over an extended period, observing the changes taking place in that object. And by focusing on an object that's changing and observing the changes, then one goes very directly into the insight of impermanence, even without going through a fixed kind of samadhi. But other teachers try to lead the student to the development of what is called upachara samadhi, access concentration, in which the nimitta appears, but the mental factors are not yet strong enough to put the mind into jhana. Then once the mind is able to go into access concentration, then the teacher will guide the student into the practice of insight meditation. Or some teachers, like Goenka, in the Goenka system, one doesn't even aim to go into access concentration. But in his typical 10-day course, one spends the first, I think it's 3.5 days, just focusing on the breath, the sensation of the breath around the nostrils. And then one moves on the fourth day into the practice of insight by observing the sensations in the body. So that's a kind of, call this one size fits all for everybody. So it's always, everybody has the same instruction, 3.5 days of the concentration practice, and then on the fourth day, afternoon, start with the insight practice. Okay, any other questions? Yes?
Yeah, Bhante, would it be possible to achieve one of these jhana state outside of the meditative experience, basically outside of the sitting or walking meditation like in our daily life?
I don't see how that would be possible. It could be that somebody who has very strong spiritual faculties might, without having learned formal meditation, might say sit down at a quiet place and then just start focusing on the breath and then just spontaneously go into the jhana state. But that would be very, very rare, and only because that person has already somehow built up a strong faculty of concentration. But cases like that would be so rare as to scarcely be worth mentioning.
What I'm trying to get at is, would it be possible to carry the state of meditation, concentration, even after one gets up from the...
Oh, I see, to carry the concentration after getting up.
Throughout the day, yeah.
One can keep some degree of concentration throughout the day, but one can't go about one's activities in a state of jhana. It has to be done in the sitting meditation, because what happens even in the first jhana is that the factors, these two factors of applied thought and sustained thought, have to be focused on one object, which is the object of concentration. And if one is going about one's activities, one has to have different changing objects. Okay, I want to just take some of these internet questions, then I want to come back and try to finish the sutta. Okay, what is the difference between piti and sukha? I don't want to go into a technical discussion of the difference, but let it just suffice to say that piti is what is translated as rapture. It's a joyful, exhilarating state, whereas sukha is mental pleasure, a feeling of pleasure. Okay, then next question. Nowhere is it mentioned that in the process of developing the four jhanas that all five senses stop functioning. Why is it not included as part of the five jhana factors in describing jhana? Yeah, it's simply nowhere said that the five senses stop functioning. And it's only in connection with the formless jhanas that that the senses stop functioning. Okay, it is said that without completely letting go of attachment to the body, it is impossible to attain jhana. It seems that total abandonment of the five hindrances include letting go of bodily awareness. I have to say, this gets to a rather technical point, but to my mind, this is not so compatible with what is said in the sutta. The sutta seems to indicate that there is a bodily awareness even in the jhana, since it speaks about the meditator pervading, how does it go? He drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades this body with the pleasure of the jhana. Okay, I want to move on now to try to finish the sutta. Okay, the four jhanas represent the achievement of samadhi, which is mental concentration. And this is the second stage of the threefold training. It's not yet liberation, not yet nirvana, but it's just a strengthening of the mind, the opening up of new dimensions of experience, so that the mind can then be used for developing insight or wisdom. And it's insight or wisdom that will bring liberation. And so in a straight development of the path, the meditator can go directly from the jhanas to the development of insight. But in this sutta, the Buddha is going to explain the development of wisdom or knowledge in terms of three higher knowledges. The first two, strictly speaking, are not necessary parts of the path. But the Buddha himself experienced these with his own achievement of enlightenment, and he taught them, since many of his disciples apparently had the ability to achieve these states. I think there's also a subtext here, or a little bit of an agenda, which explains why the Buddha often explains his the achievement of enlightenment in terms of these three knowledges. Okay, now these three knowledges, the Pali word is vijja. You see, you have to be more mindful. Okay, now the Brahmins in the Buddha's time had a group of texts that they regarded as sacred, their holy scriptures, which they memorized and recited and used for the performance of rituals. And these texts were called the Vedas. And there were three Vedas: the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, and the Yajur Veda. Now, the word, Sanskrit word vidya, or Pali word vidya, originally meant knowledge of the Vedas, the wisdom that the Brahmins believed they derived from the study of the Vedas. And so a Brahmin who mastered the three Vedas was called Te Vijja, one who knows the three Vedas. It's a little bit like in our time we have PhD, Doctor of Philosophy. You know, that's in the educational field, that's considered the crowning achievement. So for the Brahmins, the crowning achievement was to be Te Vijja, a master of the three Vedas. And now, sort of, if we read the text in this kind of, maybe call it, is it, this we call post-structuralist, or light, you know, trying to look for underlying agendas, we can see that the Buddha is setting up a different set of three knowledges against the knowledges of the Brahmins. So for the Buddha, the three knowledges are the knowledge of one's previous lives, the knowledge of how beings pass away and take rebirth in accordance with their karma, and the third is knowledge of the destruction of the defilements. Of these three, the one that's really important, that's essential in the Buddha's scheme of the path, is the third knowledge, knowledge of the destruction of defilements. But, again, for the reasons that I said, partly because the Buddha wanted his disciples to achieve the same knowledges that he himself realized, at least those disciples who had the ability to achieve them. And partly, I think, or I suspect, to sort of counterbalance the three knowledges of the Brahmins, the Buddha often speaks of these three higher knowledges as goals for a disciple to achieve. And these higher knowledges, especially the first two, are achieved on the basis of the four jhanas. So first one has to master the fourth jhana to make the mind very calm, concentrated, collected in the fourth jhana. And then on that basis, one directs one's attention back throughout one's present life, and then directs the attention back past the moment of conception in this life, till it sort of breaks through that barrier put up by the previous death, and one is able to recollect one's immediate past life. Then one repeats the process, going back through one's immediate past life till one comes to the moment of conception in that life. Then again one directs the mind more and more strongly till one breaks through the barrier of the preceding death, and one can recollect the life before that. And so as one sort of cultivates the skill, the time comes when one can recollect many past lives. So the sutta says, when his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. He recollects his manifold past lives, one birth, two births, then it goes on, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. To page 105, 50, 100, 1,000, 100,000 births, many aeons of world contraction, many aeons of world expansion, many aeons of world expansion and contraction. Okay, so one knows what one was named, what one looked like, what kind of food one ate, very important. One's experience of pleasure and pain, how long one lived, how one passed away, where one was reborn next, and so on and so on. Then the simile compares this to a man who might go from one village, from his own village to another village, then perhaps even to other villages, and then return to his own village. And so he could remember at a later time, I went from my own village to that village, there I stood in such a way, sat in such a way, spoke in such a way, kept silent in such a way, then I went from that village to another village, and so on and so on and so on, until I came back to my own village. Okay, so in this way he recollects his many past lives with their aspects and their details. So that is the first higher knowledge. The second higher knowledge, again with the concentrated mind, he directs his mind to knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of other beings. And then he sees how beings pass away and take rebirth in accordance with their karma. This is on page 106. You can read it on your own, but basically he sees how beings who did unwholesome deeds with body, speech, and mind took rebirth in lower realms, that experience much suffering, and how beings who do wholesome deeds with body, speech, and mind take rebirth in higher realms and experience happiness. And so this is like the case where there are two houses with doors, and then there's a man with good sight standing between them, and he could see people passing back and forth between the two houses. And so with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, the monk sees beings passing away and taking rebirth, and he understands how beings pass on from life to life in accordance with their actions or karma. Then we come to the third higher knowledge, again with a concentrated mind, or he directs his concentrated mind to knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the taints, or the deep-rooted mental defilements. He understands as it actually is. Now, this is the essential knowledge. This is the knowledge of insight that brings liberation. So actually, to reach the destruction of the taints, one has to direct the mind to the three characteristics of the five aggregates, to impermanence, to their nature of suffering, to their nature of non-self. As one develops the insight into impermanence, suffering, and non-self, eventually one reaches the world-transcending wisdom by which one penetrates the Four Noble Truths. Then one sees this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And one sees these are the asavas, this is their origin, this is their cessation, this is the way to their cessation. And when one knows and sees thus, then the mind is liberated from the asavas. It's liberated from the taint of sensual desire or sensual craving. It's liberated from the taint of craving for renewed existence in samsara. And it's liberated from the taint of ignorance. So when it's liberated, then there comes the knowledge of liberation. And one understands birth is destroyed, that is, the cycle of rebirths is ended. The holy life, the life of the Noble Eightfold Path, has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of becoming, of renewed existence. And this is compared to a lake deep in the mountains, clear, limpid, undisturbed, and then a man with good eyesight standing on the bank could look into the lake, and he would see shells, gravels, and pebbles, and also shoals of fish swimming about and resting. And as he looks in, then he would know this is the lake, clear, undisturbed, these are the shells, gravel, and pebbles, and these are the shoals of fish swimming about and resting. And so, in this way, the monk understands the Four Noble Truths and understands that his mind is liberated. Okay, at that point now, the Buddha has completed the whole series for the whole sequence of training of the factors that make one a samana, an ascetic, that makes one a Brahman, in the Buddhist sense of a holy person. Okay, now what follows depends a lot on wordplay, which it's almost unrepeatable in English. Okay, we'll go into paragraph 22. A bhikkhu such as this is called a recluse, a Brahmin, one who has been washed, one who has attained to knowledge, a holy scholar, a noble one, an arhat. Okay, so how is a bhikkhu a recluse? That is a samana. These are based on word plays that you might say that, oops, if you saw them on television, you would say that these are bad jokes because they're not really etymological. Okay, there's one word in Pali, samana, which is what we translate recluse. But it actually comes from the root shram, which means to work or to labor. So a shramana is one who strives. But here the Buddha is deriving it from another word. This is, in Sanskrit it would be shama, which means peaceful. And then we have the past participle, samita, which means quieted down, become peaceful. So he is called a samana because he has quieted down the bad, unwholesome states that defile, that bring renewal of becoming, that cause trouble, that ripen in suffering, and that lead to future birth, old age, and death. So that is how the monk is a recluse. So there's a wordplay between samana, meaning a recluse or ascetic, and samita, meaning peaceful or quiet. Then how is the bhikkhu a Brahmin? Okay, here we have the Sanskrit word brahmana. But in the Buddha's time, we can guess that the word was actually pronounced probably something like bhavana. And so here the word play is with bhavita, which means expelled, the bhavana. So brahmana is actually the Sanskrit form that was brought back later into the Pali text. But in the Buddha's time, in colloquial languages, the word was pronounced bhamana. And so here, there's a wordplay with another word, bhahita, which means expelled, driven away. So why is one a brahman? He has expelled unwholesome states. Okay, then when a Brahmin would finish his studies, he would undergo a certain ceremonial bath by which it sort of symbolizes that he's washing away his mental taints or his soil, his mental taints or defilements. And so the monk, such a monk is called one who has been washed because he has, through his liberation, he is washed away evil and wholesome states. Okay, why 26? How has he attained to knowledge? He has known evil unwholesome states that defile. How is he a noble one? How is he a holy scholar? Well, this is too difficult to explain. Anyway, just take it from me that it's a wordplay that's somewhat difficult to explain. So the evil, unwholesome states have streamed away from him. How is he a noble one? Here the Pali word is Arya, and it's related to the word Arya was used by the Brahmins to refer to themselves in the sense that they considered themselves to be nobility. But here the Buddha is introducing a wordplay, deriving it from another word, Arika, which means far away from. So why is he called the noble one? Because evil, unwholesome states that defile are far away from him. Therefore, he is called a noble one. And how is he called an arahat? Again, the word arahat originally means worthy one. But here, the text is deriving it also from the word araka, which means far away. So why is he an arahat? Because the evil, unwholesome states that defile are far away from him. That is how the bhikkhu is an arahat. Okay, and that is the end of the sutta. We covered quite a lot today. But if there's any questions, please feel welcome to ask. Okay, please take the microphone. I hate to rush through like this, but I wanted to finish today.
I think you say in the text, you say the fourth jhana, the person, the Buddha directs it to the knowledge.
Yeah.
To the knowledge, but as the ability to direct one's mind is called the five sword, and the five sword is.
Say again.
In the fourth jhana,
yeah,
a person directs,
yeah,
mind to the three knowledges.
Yeah.
But is it the ability to apply one's thought is called applied thought and is eliminated.
Okay, this is a good point. Okay.
And know someone argue that one has to get out of the jhana in order to, but it doesn't mention in the sutta.
Yeah, okay, this is.
Is there any sutta in the. Nikayas mentioned that one has to get out of the jhana in order to apply it
to
direct one's mind.
Okay, yeah, this is a good point. Okay, for the recording, her point is that if we just read the sutta, it seems that one acquires these higher knowledges while in the fourth jhana, but in the fourth jhana there's no discursive thinking, right? And yet it seems that to achieve these knowledges, one has to use discursive thinking.
No, we use the applied.
Yeah, that's applied thought and sustained thought. Okay. Yeah, this is a rather technical point, but the way the commentaries explain this, one doesn't actually achieve these knowledges while in the fourth jhana itself. Rather, what one does is to make the mind purify, bright, and so on in the fourth jhana. Then one comes out of the fourth jhana, and when one comes out, one is back to the state of, we call, ordinary consciousness, but the mind is still pervaded by that very powerful, tranquil, imperturbable characteristic of the jhana mind. And then it's with this mind that's come out of the jhana that one directs the mind to the recollection of past lives, for example. And then when the knowledge actually arises, one goes into the fourth jhana again. That's the way it's explained in the commentaries and the Abhidhamma. Is there, okay, then the question is there any sutta that supports this idea? Yeah, I haven't seen any sutta that supports that. So if one just follows strictly this, what the sutta says, it seems that those knowledges arise within the fourth jhana. Yeah, but to my mind that seems difficult to understand how it could arise in the fourth jhana because of the absence of any kind of applied or sustained thought. Richard?
Well, what about the formal states?
Okay, this is a good question. How what about the formless states? Yeah, there are four states of samadhi beyond the fourth jhana. These are the base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception. Those are states which can be attained, and if one does attain them, then the mind becomes even more tranquil, the samadhi becomes even more powerful. But it seems that the Buddha doesn't mention them because they're not strictly necessary to achieve even the three knowledges. The fourth jhana itself is sufficient to achieve them. Any further questions? Okay, then we'll take it looks like this is the second of three of two pages. Okay, see, one question. The dry insight meditator clearly could not attain the first two knowledges, so what makes them think they could attain the third knowledge without the first two knowledges? It's just possible, that's all. In order to achieve liberation, it's not necessary to be able to recollect one's past lives or to see the rebirth of others. What's necessary is to have the knowledge of the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and non-self, leading to the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. So these first two knowledges could be beneficial to the achievement of the third knowledge. If one recollects one's past lives, you know, how many times I had to go to elementary school, oh, then I had to struggle in junior high school, and then high school, you know, have to go to class with that, what was his name again? Jesse, be in class with Jesse again, and with that Michael again. You know, what if I wind up again and again in the same class with those guys? And then get out of high school, have to apply to college, oh, and then graduate school, and search for a job, unemployment. If I want to travel overseas, have to apply for a passport, get on the line to the airports, the body scanners, crowded planes, oh, I can't take it anymore. And then when one sees the how others pass away and take rebirth, you know, wow, others falling into the hell realms, and maybe I could fall there. And other beings, they go, you see them go up to heaven, enjoying themselves, and then the chute opens up under their feet from the heavens, and boom! Woof, woof! Woof, woof! Woof! Meow!
Meow!
Meow! Meow! Or roar! Roar! Back to the animal realm. Worse. Okay, so that will, if one gets those two knowledges, it will plant a strong tendency to dispassion in the mind or to disenchantment. But they're not strictly necessary. Just on the basis of insight, one could achieve the third knowledge. Okay, some Buddhists say it is not important whether they believe in rebirth or karma. How can that be? Okay, that opens up a big question that I just don't have time to deal with now. Looks like there was another. Well, question three seems to, and question four seem identical. And there's question one, two someplace, but they didn't turn up, so we'll just have to end here. Okay, we can have discussion period if you like, some like that question, discussion period. Maybe we'll start about 12:30 to 1. Well, I think you can take lunch now in the dining room because the meditation course should be over. Is everything set up? Maybe it's better we come back here then. Or we could sit just on the cushions in the top, in the Kuan Yin Hall. We don't have to set up the tables. Excuse me? Yeah, Venerable Dhammadipa told me that the class will be finished this morning. Yeah, we'll go to Kuan Yin Hall. You don't have to set up tables. We'll just sit on the cushions. Excuse me. Oh, okay. So let's come back here then. Is that okay? And also, I want to mention, I put out on the table here as you go out, there are some copies, not that many, but there are some copies of this magazine called Inquiring Mind, Buddhist magazine from California. There's about 12 copies, so if anybody is interested, you could pick one up. And then I had a bunch of catalogs from L.L. Bean, the shoe manufacturer, other catalogs and pieces that I don't have the heart just to throw them away. So anybody have to do their winter shopping for winter clothes, feel welcome to pick them up and use them. Okay, let us end with, we'll end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so I'll recite them in the Pali. Akasatha Chabhumatha Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantam Anumodipa Chiram Rakantu Sasanam. Akasatha Chabhumatha Deva Naga Mahitika Punyanta Nanumodipa Chiram Rakantu Desana. Akasata Chabhumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyanta Nanumodipa Chiram Rakantu Namparam. Eta Vatacha Amhehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Deva Namodantu Sabe Bhutamamodantu Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadhaya Vichihetato Etantare Satakai Upapanna Rupiya Rupicha Sanya Sanino Dukha Pumuchantu Pusantu Nibhutin. Yeah, I should mention that next Saturday we won't have a class, but the Saturday after that, that's December 11th, we have the class again. And that class, are we going to have that in Taishu, in a Kuan Yin Hall? It'll be, the announcement will be put out, whether it'll be in Kuan Yin Hall or in the library. And the sutta that I will teach in that class also will be announced. I think it's sutta number 41. Number 41. And then the 18th will be sutta number, I think it's 46. But again, that will be included in the announcement. Okay, we do end with three bows to the Buddha, three half bows.
Bow to Bombay.